يوسف جلالي بتهران
روباشافت غازا
جروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
راشا ساغلام اسطنبول
سعيد امين عالمي كابول
شهان بات اندين ادمنستيرد كشمير
Around the world with reporters.
They gathered in huge numbers in the Irish capital on Saturday to mark the UN-recognized International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. The national march, organized by the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, was backed by more than 170 Irish civil society groups. Protesters are urging the Irish government to finally pass the Occupied Territories Bill, which would prohibit Irish companies from trading with businesses operating inside illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories.
The government made a pledge that they would pass that, and they haven't. And it can't just be about goods, it has to be about services. And the people of Ireland are demanding that. We voted for it, and they're just hiding behind politics.
Campaigners say the so-called ceasefire in Gaza is a fiction, pointing to ongoing Israeli violations and a mounting civilian death toll that adds to the tens of thousands already killed.
I'm opposed to genocide and apartheid. That's why I'm here. I've been marching for 2 years and I'll continue to march.
Humanitarian aid isn't getting in, the medical aid isn't getting in the sort of amounts they need. So it's still pretty desperate, and they're getting into wintertime there. You know, it's cold enough here today. You know, so what's it like if you're living in a tent that's in tatters?
It's a sad day for the world and a sad day for America, a sad day for Britain, sad day for Ireland, that the murder machine of Netanyahu continues.
Yeah, the conditions for people living there are intolerable, and it's not a proper ceasefire, and we're continuing to allow Israel to have people living in apartheid states, and it's not right, and we're right to come out and protest and say it's wrong.
Activists are also calling on the European Union to impose robust sanctions on Israel and to ensure the Netanyahu administration is held accountable in international courts for its crimes against humanity. Because of their complicity and because they're not listening to the electorate, there's a good chance that political parties currently in government right across Europe could be punished when national elections next arise. We've already seen something similar here in Ireland. President Catherine Connolly was elected a landslide victory. She was very anti-establishment and very pro-Palestinian. Jerome Hughes, Dublin.
With the Israeli regime routinely violating the so-called ceasefire in Gaza and committing atrocities against the Palestinians in the West Bank, the thousands who have descended upon central London today say the importance of expressing solidarity couldn't be overemphasized.
There's no ceasefire. Gaza's still in a terrible state. The West Bank is creeping into an ever and ever worse state. And the media I'm reporting this, the mainstream media, that's why I'm here. And the least I can do is to be here in a bit of rain when people in Gaza are drowning in their tents in rain.
Organized for the 33rd time, it's a demonstration to also call attention to Britain's ongoing business-as-usual relations with the regime accused of genocide and with its so-called leaders wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes.
To see Britain and America trashing the international world order in order to support Israel as it commits terrible crimes in Gaza is a matter of deep shame.
To the racist in...
On the stage opposite Downing Street, they may not mention their name, but Palestine Action, the direct action group banned under terrorist laws by the Labour government for targeting Israeli weapons manufacturing sites on UK soil, is on many people's mind.
They've managed to mute all resistance all over Europe, and now if you are pro-Palestinian, you are a criminal, or you are, it's like we are losing our democracy here. It's very important to be here today, because this is one step towards fascism, which is developing everywhere.
everyone knows is a traitor.
There's also sympathy for the six of the 24 activists jailed by the British government for trying to stop those weapons destined for the Israeli regime.
And I think in any other situation, we would hear about these things. You know, we would hear about hunger strikes if they were connected to Ukraine, maybe, or to Sudan or Congo. There's something about Palestine which means they don't even get their voices heard through the people who are trying to be allies with them here, because they're censored through.
Nearly 50 years ago, the United Nations named today the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, marking Resolution 181 advocating for the partition of Palestine into two states.
And yet another national demonstration terminates outside the halls of power, with the thousands who have gathered here saying they're here to assert that ordinary people in Britain refuse to be silent while their government continues to support a regime that is accused of genocide. Saipur is up, London.
Long live Palestine!
Supporters of Palestine in South Korea joined International Day of Action on Saturday to protest Israel's genocide in Gaza and the West Bank, and to draw attention to the one-sided peace plan of U.S. President Donald Trump.
The closest this peace proposal gets to an acknowledgement of the statehood of Palestine is in small text at the end, stating, "Only after the conditions have been carried out, there may finally be a pathway to Palestinian self-determination," leaving the freedom of Palestinians not up to their own will, but rather once again in the hands of Israel and the imperialist United States.
The death toll of Palestinians killed by Israel reaches near 70,000 people after 2 years. We're reminded to look past the data.
It's been so long since the current genocide started, and we just see numbers and numbers and numbers, and we forget that these are individuals and these are people and they have families, and we need to remember that, and we need to remember the suffering of other people across the world and how we need to stand up for all of them.
As supporters of Palestine here have emphasized, responsibility for Israel's genocide is widely shared. South Korea continues to deepen ties with Israel, including hosting the Israeli ambassador for public events and expanding military cooperation, including the provision of components for Israeli fighter jets that are still bombing Gaza. Under the cover of a so-called ceasefire, Israel's killed hundreds of Palestinians and has again widened the conflict with deadly bombings of Lebanon and Syria. While now most countries have shifted to support Palestine, more active policies are needed.
Countries need to impose more sanctions, and they need to put more pressure on the country that is aiding Israel. Being the U.S.
Recent winter rains have destroyed thousands of displaced Palestinians' tents. The U.N. demands Israel allow Palestinians to receive much-needed humanitarian and food aid. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Venezuela has been the subject of intense media attention in recent months as the United States doubles down on its pressure aimed at overthrowing the government in Caracas. In the eastern state of Anzoátegui, an assembly of local leadership meets as part of a process to fortify the United Socialist Party, the PSUV, from the grassroots level.
What the Venezuelans want is peace, prosperity, and we have our own democratic system. We have elections. We are even electing at this moment communities and popular power all over the country.
Venezuela held another election on Sunday to vote on local projects at the communal level, which will be funded by the state. And while the spectacle continues on social media, daily routines seem unaffected.
Things are happening. People are going to the beaches. People are going to party. People are working, are studying. But we are also getting ready for any scenario. If the imperialism of the USA tries to attack Venezuela, we'll know how to answer. And we will prevail. Venezuelans, the only thing we want is to be respected and for the world and for the great powers to respect our sovereignty, to respect our people and our self-determination.
Throughout the country, daily life continues for Venezuelans against the backdrop of the incessant campaign of aggression leveled by the United States against the country as the massive military buildup escalates in the Caribbean Sea.
Governor of Anzoátegui Luis José Mercado says while calm reigns, Venezuelans are prepared to defend their nation.
In our state of Anzoátegui, which is part of the Caribbean coastal region of our country, we have entered a period of permanent mobilization. What we have done for these past 3 months or more is carry out intense activity involving military, police, and popular mobilizations. Each of our 205 community circuits has an organization with militia units that have been mobilizing, holding night marches and meetings, conducting training exercises, and carrying out military-style preparations. In Venezuela, the majority of us, the women and men of this nation, are absolutely determined to preserve our independence and our sovereignty.
Venezuela is a country at peace, advancing in its various transformative projects, strengthening its economy in the face of the economic blockade and guarding its sovereignty. Camila Escalante, Anzoátegui.
The Italian capital, Rome, has hosted an event dubbed A Journey into Persian Cuisine, organized by the Iranian Institute of Culture in collaboration with the Italian National Hoteliers Association Federalberghi and the Betoia Hotel Group. The initiative aimed at presenting Iran's rich gastronomic heritage and diverse regional influences. Italy, like Iran, places utmost importance on culinary traditions.
Iranian food is one of the most important food systems in the world in diversity and health. And one of the most important our obligation is exchange these food systems and gastronomy between Italy and Iran.
Gastronomy embodies the culture of hospitality and acceptance. Everybody knows how culinary traditions are important for Italy. The same applies to Iran, where I have been kindly welcomed a few years ago.
This journey into Persian cuisine is an initiative aimed at promoting intercultural dialogue through the universal language of food. Participants say it offers them an experience that engages all the senses and opens a window onto an ancient civilization. From savory stews like Rome Sabzi and Reime Bademjoun to aromatic rice dishes such as Chelo Chebab Kubide, participants had the opportunity to discover a wide range of Iranian flavors, textures, and aromas.
The food that I like the most is the biryani labu. I love beetroot and yogurt mixed together. It tasted delicious.
The food we had today was excellent. I felt welcome and as if I was in my own home.
Now I have a crazy urge to visit Iran. Flavors were amazing. The food wasn't even too spicy. What I loved the most was the contrast of flavors in every bite.
It's called gastrodiplomacy, and it is a form of cultural diplomacy that uses food as a tool to stimulate intercultural dialogue and strengthen international relations. During the event, speakers all agreed, through the universal language of food, it is possible to better understand the other. Max Civili, Rome.
The Venezuelan embassy in Tehran marking more than a century of Bolivarian military aviation, a force that Caracas describes as revolutionary, people-centered, and central to defending the nation's independence. This year's celebration also commemorates the 33rd year since the November 1992 civic military uprising, an event that Venezuelans regard as a rebirth of their modern air force and a turning point in their political history.
We mark 105 years of our Bolivarian military aviation, and since President Chavez established our defense doctrine in 1999, we remain fully prepared to protect the country. As you know, since August, the United States has issued threats. And for more than 17 weeks, their warships have stayed deployed. President Maduro has ordered military drills. And at the same time, we face pressure on many fronts.
More than 30 military attachés from foreign embassies in Tehran attended the ceremony, an expression of solidarity amid ongoing external pressures on Venezuela. During the opening remarks, the Venezuelan ambassador addressed what he called continuous threats and coercive measures from the United States and attempts to undermine Venezuelan sovereignty under the pretext of fighting narco-trafficking.
We are fully prepared under the current circumstances. All our armed forces stand ready and follow the commander-in-chief, our president. All military commanders maintain unity and discipline, and the solidarity we see today in Venezuela is exemplary. We are prepared to defend our country and the peace of our republic.
Iranian officials at the event praise Venezuela's resilience and its alignment with Tehran's own stance of strategic independence.
I can say that Iran and Venezuela's relations are strategic because of the high-level officials of Iran, I mean the president of the Venezuela and our supreme leader. They have this very high-level will to have strategic relationships. It's because of our, our beliefs about the resistance and resilience of against the imperialists and arrogant people and arrogant governments.
For Caracas, the 105-year milestone is more than an anniversary. It is a message of continuity, resistance, and commitment to their national identity.
Iran and Venezuela may be oceans apart, but they are close in their shared fight against imperialism. And on this anniversary, Venezuela is also vowing to keep alive Simon Bolivar's legacy. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Let's start with this unrecognized and, to me, bizarre, you can probably shed some light on it, meeting back in July between Jonathan Pollard and Mike Huckabee. Huckabee is, of course, the Zionist U.S. ambassador to Israel. Pollard is the notorious theft of American national security secrets. Is Pollard a hero to the Israelis?
Well, he is, and he's a settler who is sort of a local celebrity among the religious nationalist world. I remember there was this bookstore I used to walk by in central Jerusalem where a lot of settlers would frequent when they came into Jerusalem to go shopping and so on, buy frozen yogurt. And it had a giant picture of Jonathan Pollard over the front door because at that time he was considered cause celeb to the religious nationalist movement and kind of a political prisoner in Israel. And that was the main bookstore where settlers could get messianic texts and so forth. So he's a hero to a certain constituency in Israel. And through the Adelson bribery network, Miriam and Sheldon Adelson, Donald Trump was basically paid to release him. He was sentenced to life in prison. Jonathan Pollard was sentenced to life in prison for some of the most damaging intelligence thefts in U.S. history. He was a naval intelligence analyst. He did this for ideological reasons because he believed he was an Israel firster. And he handed over the methods that the NSA used to collect intelligence to the Mossad, as well as a list of thousands of intelligence contacts, collaborators, undercover spies, the knock list that U.S. intelligence used to Tel Aviv. He did this in exchange for money, but for ideological reasons. Ultimately, Donald Trump released him, and Sheldon Adelson flew him back to Israel on his personal jet, where he is now sort of a hero. And for some reason, Mike Huckabee last July, what I call the Israeli-U.S. reciprocal ambassador, decided to meet with Jonathan Pollard in his office. And this came as news to me, but it also came as news to the White House and to the CIA. None of them knew about this. And this should be a fireable offense, considering what Pollard did to the United States. I mean, this is Aldrich Ames level spying. This is treachery. He is a traitor. What was Huckabee doing with him? No U.S. ambassador has previously met with him, but it does appear that Huckabee has ideological kinship with Jonathan Pollard. Huckabee is a Pollardite, and if Huckabee isn't fired for this, we have to ask, in what world, in what political movement, in what White House does he not get fired? It's one that believes in MEGA, making Israel great again.
Well, it wasn't on his schedule, and the press knew nothing about it. I didn't know about it until you told us a little while ago, and then I looked it up, and it just came out, I guess, in the past few days. So Huckabee must have known he needed to keep this secret from the CIA, from other embassy employees, and from the White House. I bet he didn't keep it secret from Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, he didn't keep it secret from other figures in the Trump administration, because it looks like they went to the New York Times. Three current senior officials confirmed this to the New York Times. So it looks like this is an internal problem. And it's something that I've been seeing from inside the Trump administration. There are still forces in the Trump administration that are deeply uncomfortable with the personnel in control of the policy, because they consider themselves to be Israel firsters, or as one Trump administration source called them to me, Mossad stenographers.
You know, Mike Huckabee, and I know him well, Max, because he was full-time at Fox for about 2 or 3 years during the much longer time that I was there, but I didn't know now what I now know about him.
Yeah,
he is what Tucker Carlson is being excoriated for condemning, a Christian nationalist who puts Israel above the United States, an arch Zionist. Now, I don't know how a human being nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate, the official government representative of another country, can put that other country first and expect to get away with it.
Well, all the other previous U.S. ambassadors that I can think of were Israel firsters, even under Joe Biden. Tom Nides, for example. I mean, after October 7th, he went and lobbied on behalf of the Jewish federations for more money to support Israel during its genocide. Before that, you know, under Obama, Daniel Shapiro, he stayed in Israel with his family when his term ended, and went on to lobby for the NSO group, which produces Pegasus spyware. You had David Friedman from the first Trump ambassador to Israel. This is a figure who has a part-time residence, I think, in the settlement of Beit El, is part of the Friends of Beit El, raises money for the illegal settlements from the U.S., is a complete Israel firster. I mean, he wakes up in the morning, maybe eats some cereal, and then lobbies for Israel. That's what he does with his life. But what Huckabee has done here is an act of just such naked treason, or to associate and welcome and as someone who betrayed the United States at such a high level, that I don't understand how Trump can protect him anymore, unless Trump is that fully invested himself in the Israel First program, or that this would be just too embarrassing for him. It's really Trump at this point. He has to choose between Adelson and the CIA.
Well, how does Huckabee explain this to the White House now, which he must have done by now since the time New York Times piece appeared.
It was like Pollard was like crashing some party, or he,
wow,
he broke in somehow. I don't understand what the excuse would be.
Let's talk about another Israel firster, who happens to be the United States ambassador to the UN. Why were Danny Dannon, that thug that is the Israeli ambassador to the UN, and Mike Waltz embracing each other on the floor of the Security Council earlier this week?
Yeah, a really tragic moment in the history of the UN as the Gaza Master Plan passed. And this is a plan to essentially internationalize the occupation of Gaza and a Trojan horse for permanent Israeli control and a colonial program that I can explain in a little bit more detail in a minute, but which was approved, voted for by the one Arab state on the Security Council in a non-permanent role, Algeria, and the one Muslim state in a non-permanent role, Pakistan. Two countries that had feigned concern for Gaza for the last 2 years. And then behind them, you have Turkey, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Egypt, you know, the so-called the Arabs and the Muslim states that are vying for a role as part of this international stabilization force, which is really a pacification force whose mission will be to disarm Palestinian resistance factions and put Palestinians at the mercy of the Israeli army, but behind an international flag. Now, Turkey has said that disarming Hamas without ending the occupation would be a red line. So why do they want to be involved in this? Have they spoken out against this resolution? Now you have the two permanent members that would normally veto such a thing, Russia and China. They both abstained. Russia's abstention, I think, will be as consequential, if not more, than its abstention on the vote to declare Libya a no-fly zone, which was part of what convinced Putin to run for president again, because that was during the time of Medvedev. What explains the Russian and Chinese votes, given that they harshly condemned the resolution and offered the same analysis that I just did, that it's a Trojan horse for reoccupation, that it will violate international law and so forth? They claim that they couldn't abstain, they couldn't actually veto it when you have all of the Arab states, which are basically vassals, being in favor of this international force. And after they vetoed it, you have the Palestinian Authority, the Vichy Authority that collaborates with Israel to rule the West Bank, supporting this vote. So what you've seen is the complete betrayal of Gaza by the Arab and Muslim world, and Russia and China failing to step in because I guess they don't want to complicate their relations with Turkey and Egypt and all these other mid-level powers. And Gaza is now at the mercy of what Jared Kushner called the master plan, which I can explain, but which is essentially a colonial divide and conquer plan that continues the genocide under international cover.
And will this master plan permit Jared Kushner to become the development for the very valuable waterfront real estate?
I should actually clarify, it was Steve Witkoff who referred to it as a master plan in a 60 Minutes interview, and Jared Kushner was seated beside him, and he grimaced with so much agony because Witkoff had let the cat out of the bag.
Didn't the vice president let the cat out of the bag in a similar environment where he referred to Kushner as the investor?
Yeah. I mean, Kushner is the investor in a company that has proposed Gaza seafront real estate. Kushner has himself referred to Gaza as ideal waterfront real estate property. So absolutely, Kushner is interested in the master plan. If you look at the map right now, there's this yellow line that Israel has set up preventing Palestinians from reaching the arable areas that used to be agricultural land. It cuts them off from everywhere east of Gaza City all the way down to east of Khan Yunis, Rafah is completely destroyed in the south, so there's this giant buffer, and Israel's occupying that as well as the Netzarim corridor. And that yellow line confines the population of Gaza into basically a concentration camp where Israel and the United States military, through its new civil military coordination center in the Israeli city of Kiryat Gat, control all the access points for aid. They're dumping cell phones into Gaza today. There are images of tons of cell phones being offloaded into Gaza for obvious reasons, spying and spreading destabilization. Then what Israel's going to do is, in those areas where they're carrying out demolitions, where Palestinians are not allowed to go, where they're being killed if they go, outside the yellow line, which is 58% of the Gaza Strip, they're going to create these so-called model cities. We've seen the maps for them in the Boston Consulting Group plans, and they're really like gated communities where everything will be digitized. Like the nightmare that everyone who opposed the COVID lockdowns had of 20-minute cities and globalist control, it will be fulfilled there. Everyone will be living in these biometric gated communities. Businesses will be blacklisted that do not comply with Israel, and those that are whitelisted will be run by future warlords. And the United Arab Emirates will be one of the Arab authorities administering things financially, but cash will be virtually this will be sort of a cashless society. Everything will be digitized and tokenized, biometric. Everyone will be under mass surveillance. And then anyone who remains back in the areas that were controlled by resistance factions, Palestinian grassroots factions, they will be subjected to more starvation sieges and continuous bombardment unless they move to the model areas. That's the future of the master plan until they get those areas on the waterfront for Jared Kushner and his buddies.
Gee, I wonder who will build the digital infrastructure. Probably the same people that threw you out. Palantir, probably the same people that threw you out of that conference where you tried to question them.
So Palantir has been heavily involved by the admission of its CEO, Alex Karp, who was just at the U.S.-Saudi Investment Forum at the Kennedy Center down the street 2 days ago. Alex Karp has boasted about his role in providing Israel with targeting assistance through Palantir's Maven system and participating openly in the genocide. And in the Boston Consulting Group plans for the so-called master plan, various multinational corporations, tech corporations, were put forward for contracts, Oracle, Amazon, Palantir being just among a few of those that control our media in the United States and our administration.
Wow. I want to get to Venezuela and the CIA's cocaine business with you because you've just done some extraordinary reporting on it. But before we do, I'd like you to watch this clip from John Kiriakou.
The reason, though, I'm told, that Donald Trump decided to bomb Iran was that the Israelis said for the first time, if you don't bomb Iran to take out these deep bunkers, we're going to use nuclear weapons. And they had never threatened that before. And so Trump said, bombing Iran might actually save us from the start of World War III if it keeps the Israelis from using nuclear weapons.
So according to your source, the Israelis told the President of the United States that if he did not use the United States military power to bomb the nuclear facilities in Iran, Israel, acting on its own, would use nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Do you see why there's a problem with that statement, John?
Yeah.
Because they've never admitted that they've had them.
That's right.
So you're telling me that they just admitted to the President of the United States that they have nuclear weapons and we still do not have them in the IAEA treaty.
I mean, if Israeli nuclear whistleblowers are to be believed, yeah, they've had them. They started working on them in the 50s. They got them around the late 60s or the early 70s. Look at Mordechai Vanunu. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't charged for treason for nothing.
Is this credible, Max?
It is. Jonathan Pollard, remember I mentioned him before, the Israeli spy who was in U.S. Naval Intelligence.
Right.
He gave an interview fairly recently to a fellow settler on a podcast in Israel, and he said that back in 1973, we were on the ropes. And when he says we, even though he was in the U.S., he's referring to the Israelis. the Egyptians had broken across the Sinai and were marching towards Israel proper. The Syrians were attacking from the north, and they wanted Nixon to resupply them with an emergency airlift to save Israel. And so the Israelis took U.S. officials to an airfield, showed them an A-4 jet packed with nuclear weapons, and said, if you do not authorize the emergency airlift, we will use nuclear weapons. And so Pollard is openly boasting about nuclear blackmail carried out by Israel back in 1973. That's what John Kiriakou is referring to. That's Israel's ace card. It's what Seymour Hersh called the Samson option. And the program was exposed by Mordechai Vanunu, one of the bravest whistleblowers in history, who was tortured for decades by Israel for what he did. He was a former worker at the Dimona facility.
Wow. Does the CIA traffic in cocaine?
Well, I referred to them in a debate 2 days ago on Piers Morgan with the former U.S. Ambassador James Story and a former CIA agent who was sort of made famous by Joe Rogan, Mike Baker. I referred to them as the cocaine import agency. The CIA was directly responsible for creating the so-called Cartel of the Suns that is now said to be under the control of Nicolas Maduro, was just named last week by Marco Rubio a narco-terrorist organization to justify striking Venezuela on land, possibly assassinating its leadership. And it's a completely fake construct that was created by the CIA in the early 90s to ship 22 tons of cocaine into the U.S. Now, why would they do that? They thought that this would allow them to surveil the drug running networks through the United States, identify who's selling the drugs, but they wound up poisoning our society, as Marco Rubio claims. And this was just sort of, this is the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the CIA being involved with cartels. The DEA agent who actually realized that the CIA was involved with the Guadalajara cartel in the 1980s and was using the cash to fund black operations run by Ali North in Central America was named Kiki Camarena. And what happened to him? He was tortured for days, tortured to death by Guadalajara cartel members in the presence of Felix Rodriguez, the notorious CIA agent who, back in the early 60s, presided over the execution of Che Guevara. This is all pretty well-documented stuff. But then we have figures in U.S. federal prisons like Genaro Garcia Luna, who was the most powerful law enforcement security official in Mexico for years under the administrations of Vicente Fox and Felipe Calderon. These are like the two key U.S. allies from the PAN and pre-parties, from the PAN party in Mexico. And the U.S. knew about this. State Department officials knew that Garcia Luna was colluding with the Sinaloa cartel to ship massive amounts of cocaine and fentanyl into the United States. But they continued to, they turned a blind eye to it because they had this Plan Merida with Calderon and Vicente Fox. They called him the George W. Bush of Mexico. The U.S. loved him. He was like the most pro-U.S. Mexican president. They turned a blind eye to it until it became too late, and now Garcia Luna is in a supermax prison in the U.S., sentenced to life. I mean, this is like the head of the FBI being involved directly with the cartel. I don't know what Cash Patel's up to, but I don't know if he's gone that far.
Wow. Is the CIA plotting a coup in Venezuela?
Well, Elliot Abrams seems to think they are because he's Gargamel has just resurfaced in the pages of Foreign Affairs, the publication of the Council on Foreign Relations, the veteran coup plotter who presided over the El Mozote massacre in El Salvador during the dirty wars of the 80s, who oversaw coup plots in the Gaza Strip against Hamas, who presided over previous coups in Venezuela, all of which failed. And he's now putting forward a plan for a special forces, U.S. special forces attack on Venezuela. So the CIA, I mean, Trump has authorized them to operate in a lethal fashion, essentially overtly in Venezuela. A refinery, petrochemical refinery, just exploded yesterday in a key energy producing region of Venezuela. I mean, we can put two and two together, but it's pretty rare, if not, it's very rare for a president to announce that the CIA is going to carry out covert activity. It's a psyop that Trump is deploying in order to promote fear and instability among the Venezuelan leadership in hopes that there will be mass defections among generals. But Abrams is now the most senior voice to openly support special forces attacks inside Venezuela. There's another figure named Marshall Billingsley. If you're watching this, go to his Twitter account if you want to see war-crazed, maniacal psychosis in action. He's just tweeting photos of hospitals, high-rise buildings in Caracas, a baseball stadium, fantasizing about U.S. Tomahawk strikes on these structures, and essentially claiming that this is where Maduro's bunkers are, or the vice president's bunkers. But these are political officials of a UN-recognized government, and he's calling for Israeli-style strikes on hospitals. Marshall Billingsley has worked in administration since the George W. Bush era, was testifying in Congress last October, was Trump's key guy on sanctions on Venezuela. So this is not some nobody, and this is where their thinking is going. There's only one person who can stop this crazy train, and it's Donald Trump, and I don't know if he has it in him.
He's the engineer of the train. Before we go, from Elon Musk.
You know, people often talk about sort of eliminating poverty and that kind of thing, but really how long have they been talking about that? There's lots of talk, there's lots of NGOs sort of trying to do these things, but really not succeeding. And you know, the evidence speaks for itself. But AI and humanoid robots will actually eliminate poverty. And Tesla won't be the only one that makes them. I think Tesla will pioneer this, but there will be many other companies that make humanoid robots. But there is only basically one way to make everyone wealthy, and that is AI and robotics.
What the hell is he talking about? AI and robotics are going to make everybody wealthy and eliminate poverty. You get it?
Well, they're going to make everyone unemployed, and then everyone's going to have to live off universal basic income, as the man seated to Elon Musk's left, Jensen Huang, who's the CEO of NVIDIA, said right after Elon Musk. What Elon Musk is saying makes absolutely no sense. And it shows that in the world of AI and tech, there is a messianic mentality that is being fueled by massive infusions of cash that is leading to nowhere. They talk about all the energy they need, all the gigawatts they need, but they don't exactly know what they need it for. They don't have a clear budget. Elon Musk has gotten his board of directors to approve a $1 trillion pay package for himself. Where's the money going to come from? And they're at the Saudi U.S. Investment Forum at the Kennedy Center, which was a grotesque gallery of corporate looters and Saudi monarchs and their lobbyists and Donald Trump, a real portrait of American governance at a late and decadent stage. And the Saudi Public Investment Fund, which is actually not as flush with cash as we think it is, has failed on several white elephant projects like Project NEOM, which was to align Saudi Arabia's coasts with resorts and high-speed rail and is going absolutely nowhere, has ponied up $600 billion for these AI warlords, these messianic figures, including Elon Musk, who are seeking more and more cash so they can say that that their earnings have gone up, even though they're not actually selling a product that is profitable at this point. Saudi Arabia generates about $1 trillion every year. So it doesn't have $600 billion to give to them. I don't know where the money is going to come from. This was just the strangest spectacle of financial fantasy. And essentially what we're witnessing is a kind of Ponzi scheme in which all of this money is being directed into AI. Our money, Saudi money, but it's not coming back. It's not necessarily creating jobs. It's causing consumers to pay more for electricity bills through all these data centers. And it's fueling a bubble, much like the dot-com bubble of the 1990s. And if you look at NVIDIA's earnings, you have all of these investors with short positions on NVIDIA right now. NVIDIA's taking in all this money, but it's not actually generating anything. It looks like the bubble could burst and do irreparable harm to the U.S. economy, and we're going to go back and look at that scene there of Elon Musk predicting the end of poverty and gather up our pitchforks.
You mean Donald Trump's sons will not get to build Trump Towers in Saudi Arabia?
I don't know what they're building, but they're props to Eric Trump and his crypto business, which has taken in $1 billion of completely opaque bribes for the Trump family from often foreign governments and foreign figures. We'll never know who they are. That was impressive.
Say that love strikes only once. That precious moment I offer you. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest road? You are my guiding light that walks me through the night. Your presence gives me strength, gives vision to my sight. Someday faith will increase, someday our wars will cease. Someday there'll be justice, someday there will be. Possess, I offer you. I want to be someone whom you can trust. Come save us from a world that's so unjust. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where
this is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, lowering the gaze. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z here on Arab English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously, the topic of lowering the gaze is, in a sense, it's always topical. This is not something that just applies to, let's say, immediately after the Islamic Revolution, during the Holy Defense, and indeed the years after that. This is just as relevant because obviously we see in our societies, whether we're in the, like, for example, in West Asia, or whether we're in the sort of, let's say, the rest of the world, in the Western countries in particular, this is relevant everywhere. It's a, and obviously this is why in Islam we advise to lower the gaze. Now, lowering the gaze does not just apply to men, it also applies to women. I'll immediately say that. And lowering the gaze is obviously that it's a sort of attitude too. So it's not just looking away. So it's looking away. It's dressing in a particular way that is modest. And that's that. So I'll just say that in a very sort of broad and general way. And it also refers to, you know, the way we talk, the way we behave. But let me just give just as an example from the life of the famous martyr, Sayyid Jan Bazurgi from Lahore Defense. So he obviously practiced this idea of lowering the gaze. So at his wedding in his wife's in the family of his wife's house, for example, he was extremely modest, not just towards his wife, but also to all the other women in the house. So he was actually, it was said that he was shy, both of his wife and of the other women. So he could barely look even at his wife and for sure at the other women. You know, this is something that maybe when some of us hear this nowadays, we think, oh, you know, we're not like that. That's not how people behave in our modern society. But look, I will talk about that a little bit because it's highly relevant, to be honest. Welcome back to Age Said here on I'm Being Shwayed with me, Sister Zainab. And so I'm talking about lowering the gaze, and I'm talking about this sort of like this whole attitude that goes with it, because it is so important. So what can we say about lowering the gaze? Obviously, it's something that is prescribed to us anyway. So what I'll say is that when we're surrounded by other people, whether it's, say, on the street, whether it's at uni, in the workplace, or if we have a big family gathering, maybe there's family members, and maybe there's even other friends or mixed genders, you know, it's fine. Our eyes, we almost cannot avoid seeing someone else, for sure. But what, where the problem then arises is if we sort of, yes, the word gaze. Gaze is to sort of really sort of take in more than just, you know, that first glance. So if when we're walking down the street and we sort of, you know, we just look at someone, you know, that's fine. Our eyes are always sort of gauging what's in the external world. Also just to sort of gauge what are there any dangers there. Do we need to be careful? Someone about to bump into us? Is there a cyclist to sort of getting too close to us? You know, whatever it is, we need to be observant anyway of our surroundings. But the territory that is tricky, and in fact I would say dangerous, is when we then sort of look the second time, or when we are actually gazing, so taking in. And I'll actually spell this out. So, for example, if we're a man, if we're then looking at someone and we're sort of like gazing, taking in their body, so we can sort of say, oh, that woman has a nice body, and we're saying that to ourselves. And this is not in the sense of telling off and sort of feeling, oh, we're all righteous. No, this is something we need to be aware of, every one of us. So are we doing this ourselves? Because we're not meant to. So this is where we really need to take stock ourselves. And, you know, obviously, for sure, if we've become aware that we're doing this, you know, we need to ask forgiveness of Allah. And for sure, we should not be admitting these flaws to others. So we should not be saying to other people, especially, oh, look, I saw that woman, or I saw that guy, and yeah, he's a nice body. No, please not. Because, you know, we're exposing our faults to others. So this was obviously very honest, and I pray that you sort of appreciate that and take stock. And, you know, we really need to be a lot more careful. So that was it for today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of Age Said here on IB English Radio. Me, Sister Zainab, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to all the listeners from around the world. You are tuned in to Iran Radio for the next hour. We start this hour's lineup with a spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. Q&A on Islamic beliefs follows next. The program provides answers to listeners' questions about Islamic beliefs. Stay with us for the next hour.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.